Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to a very special program and evening that is educational and jarring at the same moment. Together with a very special thank you to all the sponsors. Particularly to Andrea and Miriam, who worked so diligently to make this evening happen. You are about to participate in one of the most emotionally filled evenings that many of you have experienced. Our guest this evening, Father Dubois, whom I met only a few hours ago, shared with me just an overview of some of the stories that he experienced, maybe three among thousands, and I probably could not hear too much more. To tell you the extent of the horror that he has uncovered that has never been recorded before is a particular event that he shared with us in this small village or city of Satano. Also mentioned to me that in Hebrew it refers to Satan. That when the Nazis came into that environment, because of their extraordinary, diabolical, evil approach to the Jewish community, they had various means by which they would murder men, women, and children. It was not necessarily through gas chambers, as you will hear, crematorias, or even shootings. In this instance, they found a large cave under the marketplace where they herded the few thousand Jews that lived in that community that they had a record of. And they sealed the wall after smoking the place. And the person who testified on camera about this event, which she witnessed, said that the marketplace shook for 7 days as all of the Jewish men, women, and children who were in the cave died a painful and slow death. That's only one of the instances that Father Dubois shared with me. Tonight is an opportunity for the Jewish community to hear about things that many of you have not heard before. At the Yad Vashem Memorial, it indicates that in Russia, between 750 and 950,000 Jews were murdered. According to the latest statistics developed by Father Dubois and his research, there were more than somewhere between 1.5 to 1.8 million and possibly more. So the number moves quickly from 6 million to a lot more than 7 million. Tonight is not a discussion of ideology or theology. It's not a dialogue of religions. Tonight is an exposure to a humanitarian effort that is extraordinary. I'd like you to give your attention to my dear friend, Mr. Arya Rubin, who's the head of the Targum Shlishi Foundation, that spent a great portion of his life, though he's a successful businessman, great portion of his life to make the world a holier and better place. Mr. Arya Rubin.
Good evening, Rebbe Tzinchani, Rabbi Lipsker, Father Desbois, and a hearty thank you to all of you for being here. There's a lot to do in Miami. And the fact that you came here, we appreciate it. I'd like to give a special welcome to any survivors that are here with us. Do you want to stand up, please, so that we know that some of Mr. Goldstein, Mr. Sparra. And we also have the only Miami survivor of Pearl Harbor here today, World War II vet. My name is Aryeh Rubin, and I am the director of the Targum Shlishi and one of the sponsors of tonight's lectures. I'm honored to be here tonight and to be introducing Father Patrick Desbois of Paris, France, who will be speaking about his extraordinary work in locating mass graves in the Ukraine and elsewhere. Before I begin the formal introduction, I'd like to note that Father Desbois, as we speak, is missing an award ceremony in New York to be here. His book, The Holocaust by Bullets, is the winner of the 2008 National Jewish Book Award. Congratulations and mazel tov. A big thank you to the evening's other sponsors, the Shul of Bal Harbor and Miriam Gitman for all the work that she's done on this event, the Judaic Studies Program of the School of International and Public Affairs at the Florida International University, and John Stack, Director of the School of Public Affairs, as well as Professor Oren Steer and Pedro Bato for their help, the Holocaust Memorial and its director, Avi Mizrahi, Books and Books and Mitchell Kaplan and Christina Nosti, and of course, Yachad and Unim, Father Desbois Foundation and his staff, Marco Gonzalez, Joanna Lair, and Stephanie Blyer. And a special thank you to Targum Shlishi's program director, Andrea Gallen, for all her hard work. If she was the one who pulled us off, and she deserves a special applause. After Father Desbois' lecture, we'll have a question and answer period moderated by Professor Oren Steer, followed by a book signing by Father Desbois. His book, the one that won the National Book Award, is available for sale here through Books and Books. A special heartfelt thanks to Rabbi Lipsker for agreeing to host Father Desbois at the Shul of Bal Harbor. I applaud Rabbi Lipsker for doing the right thing and for recognizing the incredible importance of the work that Father Desbois is doing, for putting up for, I guess, some of the obstacles that were in the way to get this to happen. For Rabbi Lipsker's commitment, for his courage, and for his understanding, please now give him a big round of applause. Where is it? I'm getting even. This is a historic evening because tonight we are applauding a most righteous Gentile, one of the Hasidei Umot HaOlam. We are here to acknowledge the profound significance of Father Patrick Desbois' accomplishment. Father Desbois has devoted himself to uncovering the history of the massacres of the Jews in the Ukraine and elsewhere by the Einsatzgruppen, the Nazi mobile killing units. We know very little about this period because there were almost no survivors. Father Desbois is now finally telling us what happened. He and his team travel to the Ukraine every other month to interview villagers who witnessed the killings. And these witnesses were children. Those are the only ones that are still alive. Recently, he has also traveled to Belarus, and he'll tell us about it. He hopes to carry out his work in Russia in the near future. I might add that his work in Russia is being done through the full cooperation of Chabad, who is opening the doors for him there. Father Desbois is uncovering history that was literally buried until now. He is not only bringing proof of the history to the world, but he is revising the calculus of the Holocaust. As Rabbi Lipsker mentioned, when he began his work approximately 5 or 6 years ago, it was believed that 800,000 Jews were murdered in the Ukraine and Soviet Union. His work now indicates that there is close to 1.5 million, and he's not saying this publicly, he's saying this privately, so I'm sharing it with you, and it'll probably go higher. His preliminary work in Belarus has already revealed evidence of more mass graves than we originally thought. And based on that, it seems that more than 7 million Jews were killed during the Shoah. Now that's a big number. But more importantly, he is giving dignity to each and every one of those people who were brutally murdered by recording the testimony. We must honor the dead by locating their bodies, and we must document history before it's too late so that we know the truth of what really happened. Because Holocaust denial is widespread throughout Europe, Fathers des Bois' work is ever more important. If a Holocaust victim could rise up from one of these mass graves, I believe he would ask these three questions. Question one, how is it possible that the world did not move heaven and earth to save the Jews? And we know that the world did very little, and the Jewish people did very little. You were either lucky enough, rich enough, or smart enough to get out, but you did it on your own. Two, why did we not all do in our power to prosecute the Nazis after the war? After all we had to go is to the phone book in Hamburg, and we know who did the work in the Ukraine and match him up. 99.9% of the murderers got away with it. And three, the third question that this Holocaust victim would ask is, why did we do nothing to find out where the victims are buried? Now, we know it's too late, pretty much too late, to do anything about the first two questions. But Father des Bois is affording us the last opportunity to address question three. This is our last chance to gain a little bit of self-respect as Jews in terms of facing our responsibility to the victims of the Shoah. There's a story told about Simon Wiesenthal in which he explains why he became a Nazi. A survivor asked in the war, why are you going to become a Nazi hunter? You're a successful architect. Vienna is being rebuilt, you'll make a fortune. So this is a quote that he said. I believe in the world to come. I believe in the Olam HaEmet. I believe in Olam Haba. And when I get there, I'll be met by millions of Jews who aren't so lucky and who died in the camps. And they'll say to me, Simon, you were one of the lucky ones. What did you do with your life? You survived. And I'll be able to tell them, I didn't forget you. Close quote. Father des Bois has not forgotten. Through his work, he is offering us the opportunity to honor him, to support him, and ultimately to be able to say that we haven't forgotten either. This is why Targum Shlishi spearheaded a fundraising and informational campaign for him last year. The amount we raised was only in the drop of the bucket of what he needs to carry out his mission. He has always operated on an extremely tight budget. I want to note here a fact that I have on good authority that Father des Bois does not know that I know, and certainly does not want me to share with you, but I'll share anyway. To help his finances operations in the Ukraine, you know that the priests take a vow of poverty, but he did have some heirlooms, family heirlooms and antiques that his family had left to him. He has slowly been selling off this antique furniture to pay for the mass grave search in the Ukraine. That's dedication. Father, you'll forgive me. Father des Bois, who speaks Hebrew quite well and Yiddish, is an unusual man and an unusual priest. In addition to his work locating mass graves, he is a secretary of the French Conference of Bishops for Relations with Judaism, advisor to the Cardinal Archbishop of Lyon, and advisor to the Vatican on Jewish religion, which is essentially like running a branch of APAC for the Vatican. He makes sure that the vote in the College of Cardinals goes the right way when it comes to Jewish issues and Israel. He was a personal aide to the late Archbishop of Paris, Cardinal Jean-Marie Lustiger, or Listiger to us Ashkenazim. Father des Bois was awarded the Medal of Valor by the Simon Wiesenthal Center, the Humanitarian Award by the U.S. Holocaust Museum, and the very prestigious Jan Kosky Award of the American Jewish Committee. I am one of those who believe that the teachings of the Catholic Church set the historical stage that allowed the Holocaust to occur. But I also believe that the Catholics and the Christian world as a whole have made their peace with us, and will never again be involved in genocide against Jews. This doesn't mean that anti-Semitism has vanished. It's still alive and well in many parts of the world, but we now have another major religion to worry about. But if we need proof that times have changed, Father Desbois, the righteous Gentile, and the work he is doing is carried out with the blessing of the Catholic Church with the support of the Catholic Church. Father Desbois is a man with vision and unusual drive. He has said that it is, and I quote him now, a great sin to forget, it is a great sin to speak of the Holocaust and not bury the bodies and say Kaddish, close quote. I think the best way to introduce Father Desbois is to view a short 7-minute film that will give us an overview of his work. Thank you.
I will directly try to explain first why a Catholic priest originally from France, from Burgundy, who is well known from the wine, what he's doing? What he's doing in the killing fields of Ukraine, Belarus, and Russia? My grandfather was deported as military in July 42 in a small village, Ravaruska. And here there are Jewish people that I know that their family were from Ravaruska. When he came back, because he came back, he refused to speak. He didn't speak to his wife, to his sister, to his son, to nobody. And me, I was a child, 6 years old, and I was wondering why he didn't speak. One day, finally he told me, inside the camp, it was awful. No food, no drink. But outside the camp, it was worse. And me, as a child, I was wondering, what can be worse than a camp? Later, I was a mathematics teacher. Then I became priest, and I went back to Ravaruska. We built a small memorial for the camp of my grandfather, and we decided also to provide a memorial for the Jews. I asked to the mayor, in this period, it was Soviet period, and I asked, where are the mass graves of the Jews? He told me, we don't know. It was secret. They killed the Jews in the forest and there were no witnesses. And me, in that period, I was believing it was true. I came back in that village one time, three times, four times to see the mayor with the same question. Where are the mass graves of the Jews? I was a little bit like the Nudnik from France with raising always the same question. Finally, thanks God, the mayor lost the election. A new mayor has been appointed, much less Soviet. His name was Yaroslav. He told me, Patrick, I will make you a surprise. He brought me in his car from the center of Ravaruska to a small hamlet called Borove. He brought me in a limousine. You know, there are two places where I am in a limousine. It's in New York and in a small village of Ravaruska. And in this village, it was only one street, with geese and dogs barking. But at the end of the street, it was 100 old people, men and women, with their dogs, with their porks, with their animals, waiting. When I put a foot on outside of the car, we entered in the forest. And the mayor told me, Patrick, we are going to the mass grave of the last 1,500 Jews of Ravaruska. He organized people in a round, like you are today, around the mass grave. And me, I was in the middle, like today. Suddenly, one guy came outside of the crowd, and he said, Father, here there was no tree in the time of the war. It was a field. I was alone with my mother, keeping a cow. And suddenly, a German arrived here and turning with his motorcycle and a dog. And he went. And nobody understood why a German came in the field. In fact, he was looking where he wanted to dig the grave. The day after arrived three Germans with a truck and 30 Jewish men. They forced the Jew to dig a grave 8 meters deep. He remembered that the Nazis were buried during the digging, so they asked to the village a table and a gramophone to listen to German music. And one of them was playing harmonica, and suddenly he broke his harmonica. And later we found in the ground the pieces of harmonica. Arrived the time of lunch, they were hungry. So the Nazi, they asked to the village to bring 2 chicken, and they cooked them because they were afraid to be poisoned by the village. Beginning of afternoon, they said to the Jew, "Now you are tired. Go outside of the grave and take rest on the grass." And the 30 men went outside of the grave and took rest. And secretly, one German went down and put explosive under the ground. After a moment, they said to the Jews, "Now you can go on digging." And the 30 Jews exploded. At this moment, another old lady from the group came in the middle. It told me, I was a child, 12 years old, in my farm. And a German told me, come. And he asked me to climb in the trees and to pick up the pieces of corpse to put them in the grave under branches so that the next Jews will not see that the people were killed. And after trucks arrived from the center of Ravaruska to Borove, in one afternoon, only 2 men with carabine Mauser shot 1,500 Jews. They were the last Jews of Ravaruska. They were 5 Germans, 2 shooters, and 3 pushers. Why 3 pushers? Because in July 41, they established an awful law. 1 bullet, 1 Jew, 1 Jew, 1 bullet. It was a request of the army not to use too much ammunition in the genocide. So it was a catastrophe for the Jews, because if they were only injured, they were pushed alive in the grave. It's why in Borove there were 2 shooters and 3 pushers. And I remember I asked the witnesses, but how they could eat chicken? And people were yelling in the mass grave, and somebody told me, "Patrick, you don't realize, when you kill in an afternoon 1,500 people, you don't care if they yell." I remember that the witnesses said that with them was a small child, 4 years old, was going and coming from the bush to the place of the shooting. And I wonder, why a small child, 4 years old, he could not work? They told me, because the shooters, they were tied, so they put the 2 carabines on a table, and they have a black box of sweets, mint sweets. So during all the shooting, we sent a young boy to take sweets. So from one end, they were shooting, on the other end, they were giving sweets to the young child. The witnesses, they see the daily life of the killers and the assassination of the Jews. For me, this evening, it was a shock. Because in one evening, I discovered that the Jews were killed in public. In East, no secret. In West, it was secret. But in East, Jews were killed in public. And secondly, that the Nazis were using little children from Ukraine, from Russia, from Belarus, for all the dirty jobs, to carry the Jews sometime from the village to the grave, to dig the grave early in the morning, and to bring the Jews later, to bring back the suits of the Jews and to bring them in the school or in the synagogue to sell the suits of the Jews by auction. One woman, she told me, they forced me between every shooting with 14 other Ukrainian girls to go down in the mass grave and to walk on the corpse to make space for the next one. And she told me, at the end of the afternoon, all my classroom arrived because they were Jewish girls. They have been shot, and I had to walk on them like the others. At the end of the day, I was alone in the forest with Yaroslav. And Yaroslav told me, Patrick, what I did today in Ravaruska for one village, I can do for 100 villages. And I will never know why he said that, and I will never know why I said yes. I came back, I spoke to Cardinal Lustiger. He told me, I know that story because my Polish family has been shot in Poland too, in Beijing. I went in New York, I met with Israel Singer, who was at this period at World Jewish Congress, and he didn't know I was speaking Hebrew. So he said to somebody in his office, you know what? We are looking for this mass grave since 44, and this guy that we don't know, he finds them. Finally, I organized a meeting between Lustiger and Singer, and they decided to build an association, a non-profit association called Yarad Inunum. Yarad together, Inunum together in Latin. And we decided, with a team of young people, and here you have three of them, I will introduce them after, we decided to look to find all the mass graves of the Jews shot in Ukraine. You know, in the beginning, because I had a diary, I was writing, it will need only 2 time to come back in Ukraine to find all the mass graves. But after 1 year, I was still in the district of Ravaruska. Because in every village, there are mass graves. Behind every bush, in any park, under the trees, there are Jews. What happened in the village, to explain you? Because now we found 850 extermination sites. I interviewed 887 witnesses present at the execution. What happens? What happened behind the official report of the Einsatzgruppen? Because the reports were very clean, but behind, it was awful. First, they sent only one German in the village, most of the time. He's a specialist of the digging of the mass grave. He goes to see the mayor of the district, and he asks, how many Jews in the district? And I don't know if you know, but in Soviet Union, Jew was written on the passport. Like Tatar, like Armenian, it was a minority. So it was easy for the mayor to know exactly who was Jew and also where they were living. So, by example, in a district I remember, the mayor said there are 1,670 Jews. The guy, he asks to the mayor to make requisition of children in the village through the Soviet system of requisition. So the same day, he has like 50, 60 children from 6 to 16 to dig the grave. He brings them in a place and he forced them to dig the grave. You know, a mass grave, it's not a grave, it's a killing machine, because as I told you, people most of the time are pushed alive. And the mass graves are not the same, because the killers are not the same. Some mass graves are very long with stairs, because they force the Jews to go down in the mass grave and to lay on the corpse to kill them quickly. It has been built by a guy called Yekeln, chief of the police, German police, and it's called Sardinen Packung. Other mass graves are round because they want to shoot the Jews with machine gun, etc. So the digger, he makes the grave according to the chief of the unit. When it's done, he phones to the region, the mass grave is ready. They send a unit to the village. The Einsatzgruppe sends a unit. Let's say 30 persons. The local administration will phone everywhere to the Wehrmacht, German army, to the Ordnungspolizei, German police, to the Feld Gendarmerie, German gendarmerie, to the Ukrainian police, it means to anybody who had a pistol, to collect a group for the killing. All these people will surrender the village at 5 in the morning and send a call with a truck and a high voice that the Jews are deported to Palestine. You know, in that period, it was Soviet Union. So unfortunately, Jews knew what it meant to be deported. The Jews had to gather in the main street in column 5 per 5. Why 5 per 5? Because they counted them. Many Jews tried to hide themselves inside their houses or in the forest. When they found a Jew in a house, hidden, they shot him. So it means after a certain number of hours, you have a huge column of Jews and behind carts and carts with horses of dead Jews. After a certain time, they give a signal, direction Palestine. In fact, it's direction to the grave. I remember a woman, an Ukrainian witness, she was watching the column from the window, and suddenly she saw one of her neighbor, a Jewish neighbor, inside the column. And she told me I was crying, and my neighbor told me, don't cry, don't cry, we go to Palestine. And she told me I knew, because early in the morning I brought my cow behind the church, and I saw the grave. I knew where was Palestine. The Jews begin to walk, direction Palestine, 100 meters before the grave, they asked to stop and to undress from the worn dress, shapka, boots, etc., and to give their jewels. We learned after that the young girls, the young Jewish girls, most of the time refused to give their jewels to the Nazi. Sometimes we find 20, 30 wedding rings, or Magen David, or other jewels where they have been undressed, because these young girls, at the last moment, they put their jewels under her. It's the last gesture that they can do before to be shot. After they isolate them 5x5 or 10x10. Why 5x5? Because there are 5 shooters. And one bullet, one Jew, one bullet. At the end of the day, the Jews are in the mass grave, dead or uninjured. They never shoot any child. All the children are thrown alive. We found the postcard of a killer because they made photograph as souvenir. And behind, he wrote, "My dear Louisa, you see, we play with Jewish children like with balloons. We throw them in air and we try to shoot them. Imagine, my dear Louisa, what these little Jews would have done to our own children in Germany. My dear Louisa, I cannot tell you more. See you soon." And behind, you have the picture of the guy with the last Jew. Immediately in the evening, children from the village are required to bring back all the suits in the school in carts with horses. They organize the suits of the men in one classroom, the suits of the women in another classroom, the suits of the children in another classroom. And in the next days, they will sell the suits by auction. I met many people who were here this day. They said that people gathered around the school and say, "I want one jacket, I want one shirt," and so on. In every village, they told me that after 3 days, all the district was suited in Jew. We have a lot, we learn a lot of awful expression that now we hear in every village. After, they send an address to bring all the Jewish furniture from the Jewish houses in the school and to sell them also by auction. I met 4 weeks ago, I was in Ukraine. It was Orthodox Christmas, Christian Christmas. And a guy, he told me, they forced me to dig the grave 4 meters per 4 meters. After I was hidden behind the bush, I look at the shooting. I have to fulfill the grave. And 2 days after, they asked me to take the furniture in the Jewish houses. And this only problem for him, he told me many Jewish houses had a few floors. So we had to bring ropes to take the furniture through the windows, to put them in carts, and we have chosen to sell them in the synagogue. Normally, this sale by auction takes 3 weeks. So it means that in this small village, after 3 weeks, there are no more furniture, no more suits, no more Jews. It means nothing, because the houses were the property of the state. It was Soviet Union. The first killing took place in Sokal by the German army the 23rd of June 1941, the first day of the war. And the last killing was the last day of the war. Why? The killings went so far until 44. Officially, if you read the books, after 42 there are no more killings because it's finished. In fact, the SS are lying to Berlin. Himmler pushed them to make competition between SS, police, and Einsatzgruppe. So every unit of killers wants to have a report that the city very quickly is Judenfrei, free of Jews. In fact, they found new families, they kill them, and they don't declare them. It's why, for one official shooting, you have minimum in a village 10 non-official shootings. It's why there is such a gap between the German archives and the ground. More, the killers were far from Berlin, far from the Reich. Officially, they don't keep Jewish women in the Gestapo. In main majority of the Gestapo, they have chosen the day of the execution 20, 30 Jewish girls. For example, in the village where you saw the excavation in Busk, they kept 34 Jewish girls as forced workers, but also as sex slaves inside the Gestapo. Just one day before the end of the war, all these girls are pregnant. They don't dare to shoot them because they know them. So they call another unit from Sokal to come and to shoot them. And these girls, as they know they will die, they ask to the Nazi that they can make a tour in the truck in which they have been brought to say goodbye to all the village. It means that all the village saw this woman saying goodbye to everybody. It took with my team 3 days to find where was the mass grave of the girls. Nobody wanted to speak. Finally, an old woman in a small village, shaking like that, told me, they shot this girl just near my house, and we discovered the grave of the girls. Now that I know in every village, I raise the question, where is the mass grave of the girls? And as they see that I know, they speak, and they indicate me where it is. So, to let you know, there was such a gap between the official version of killing units, well-organized, professional shooters, killing men. No, they were only murderers who shot the Jews one by one. In Holocaust in East, every victim saw his killer, every killer saw the victim. It was a personal crime. No camp, no gas chamber, no train. Shooting from the border of Poland until Ossetia. You know where is Ossetia? You heard about it, about the problem of Georgia. Nobody, when they think of Ossetia, they think of mass grave of Jews. It's a continent of extermination. Holocaust by bullets. Thank you. You see my team. See, I'm not alone. Marco is the general director of Yerad Inunum. I take this opportunity to introduce him. Stephanie, who is just near, is in charge of a non-profit in New York. And Joanna, who is after, is a PhD girl, and she's in charge of foreign affairs for our small organization. Holocaust by bullets concerns Ukraine. Minimum 1.6 to 1.8 victims. Belarus, minimum 600,000. Russia, minimum 200,000. Romania, Moldavia, Transnistria, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, and 10% of the Jews of Poland. Because when they build a ghetto, you never see an hospital who enter in the ghetto. You never see very old people who enter in the ghetto. They are shot before. And inside the ghetto, they enter in the ghetto for shooting. It's why my association, Yarad Inunum, is confronted to an incredible challenge. Witnesses are very old, between 75 to 1991, 92. You know, in East, people are very poor. We die earlier than in West. We think that maximum 6-7 years, it's a short-term challenge to find minimum 2,700,000 corpses. We covered already exactly 0.5% of the territory of Ukraine. And we finished one region of Belarus, the region of Vitebsk, where from is Chagall, that is very well known. Same situation in Belarus. Only one difference. In Belarus, everybody was partisan against the Nazi. I will give you an example. I met a family in a small village near Vitebsk. They were hiding 14 Jews. Suddenly, they have been denounced. A German policeman enters in the house and finds one Jew under the sofa, a young Jew. In front of all the family, he took this young Jew, he took his knife, and he took all the skin of the back of the young Jew. And after, he brought him to the mass grave. This woman that I interviewed was 91. She was 14 years when it happened. She decided to be partisan. She told me, I killed myself 40 Germans. It's another world. Why we are doing that? Why a guy like me is doing that? You know, I believe also in the Bible. In the very beginning, you remember that Cain is killing Abel. And you remember the question that Hashem raised to Cain? He told him, where is your brother? And I think since I am a child, through my grandfather, through my family, my education, I hear this question, where is your Jewish brother from Ukraine, from Belarus, from Russia? He's in the fields, behind the church, under the park, anywhere. And you remember the answer of Cain? He said, am I my brother's keeper? Am I the guardian of my brother? It's not my question. And all of us in the West, we can say the same. We have so many problems to solve. You remember that at the end, Hashem says, don't you hear that the blood of Abel is rising from earth until heaven? I think in my conscience, and I am not alone now. I have my team, but I have also strong friendship around me. We will not be able to build Europe, to build America, to build a modern world with values, human values, if we don't bury the victims of the Holocaust. What will we say to Rwanda, to Cambodia, to Darfur, if we don't bury the victims who have been killed in our continent? And what we will say after our death, when we will meet these people, to say, we had no time to bury you. You know what? What will we say? It's impossible. It builds us on a strong, huge sin. It's why we try to stand and to be strong. And I am very thankful to Ari Rubin and all the people who helped us here in this region of Miami with Targum Shlishi. Very thankful also to the Lubavitch. Because, you know, in East, if today I can enter in Russia, if I can enter in the small village of Belarus, always in a small hidden village when there is a Jewish community, sooner or late, there is a Lubavitch rabbi who is here since 10 years, 15 years, and without the Lubavitch, no Jewish community in Eastern Europe. So this evening, I came only to share with you this worry. As said Arye, I was supposed to be to an award reception in New York. I felt much more important to be in a shul and that together we turn our eyes to all our brothers who are waiting for us. Thank you.
Father Dubois, this is the third time I've heard you speak. And every time I hear you, I learn something new. May you continue to do your work for many, many years. I'm sure the audience has a lot of questions. I'm going to ask you to keep the questions and comments short so that as many people as possible have the opportunity to ask. We have fixed microphones down here and upstairs. I'll give you a minute to come up to them. I can't move them, I've been told. Also, let me remind you that after the Q&A period is finished, there will be a book signing outside. I know many of you will probably like to speak to Father Dubois at length, particularly some of the survivors, and there will be a couple of Father Dubois' assistants will be there to take some notes, names, numbers, etc. Please, Rabbi.
Father, I would like to know whether in your work you were able to get assistance and help to trace, as you call the graves, from the German government today.
Oh, good question. I work alone since 10 years, and we all, my team, part of it is here since 5 years, to find the mass grave in Eastern Union, the mass grave of the victims of the Einsatzgruppen. And since 10 years, I never got even a small article of a German newspaper about that. Recently, thanks to the American Jewish Committee from Berlin, who organized a strong meeting in the French Embassy in Berlin with 190 politicians, we succeeded to present these discoveries in Germany. I can tell you that it was a very strong silence. Why? Because we bring back in Germany a very bad news. It was not the Nazi who killed the Jews. It was any guy who had a pistol. It could be military, it could be policeman, it could be Ukrainian, it could be Belarus, it could be Russian, it could be soldier. It's working. I remember that they helped me to meet politicians high level near Madame Merkel and inside the Bundestag. I was very shocked, because everybody after a while told me, you know, Father, it's not our vocation to bury the Jews. Finally, I told them at each time, even if it was tough, I say, okay, but it was also not your vocation of your grandfathers to kill them. And finally now, they are thinking perhaps to support us, perhaps. But until now, nothing.
Thank you very much. I am a Judaica librarian, and my friend this past summer presented in Yad Vashem a whole curriculum for public schools of the Holocaust. So I hope that she and I will be able to help your organization to put out something good for education. She's worked starting with kindergarten till eighth grade. And through this, we will make for you, God willing, much support.
You are right. We opened in Paris a center of teaching Holocaust in connection with Sorbonne. You must know it's the first time Sorbonne teach Holocaust. They opened a course for PhD and a course for master too, is the first time. And in our center in Yaradunum, we collect all the archives, the oral memory, so that people can have a PhD in a course with Sorbonne about Holocaust in East. And in Sorbonne today, in each year, 20 students inscribe them to have a PhD. That's important because in France, the youngest researchers were 60 years old. But in East, we are not at this point. We are at the point Aleph. We are not confronted to the problem to teach Holocaust. We are at the problem to bury the Jews. You must know also, because here we are in a religious place, But unfortunately, today in Ukraine, they unbury the Jews. Most of the mass graves are reopened by the neighbors to find gold teeth. By example, in Kovel, you have a small memorial, very nice, but not on the place of the killing, because they wanted to keep the grave as a gold mine. And you have perhaps 10 or 15 holes with all the bones outside scattered everywhere. It's why we work with yeshivot and with the local rabbis, mostly most of them are Lubavitch, to know what to do concretely. And the Alaric question is not the same according to the different places. But you must know it's not easy. As I say in my team, if I was without my bodyguard, it would be very complicated. Because you must understand, it's not like here or like in France. The family of the killers are still very violent. The other day in Kovel, somebody shot to us from a window. And it would be impossible without bodyguard to work. So it's why when I say that I have young people coming with me in the fields of Ukraine, of Belarus, working with me, you must support with your faith, with your friendship, also these young people who are behind me. Without these 11 young people, nothing could stand. And it's not easy when you are young to be in the middle of buildings where people are shooting.
I am here today with my mother, who's a survivor of Transnistria concentration camp. She talks...
Which one?
Bershad.
Bershad, yeah.
We have been in Bershad. And she was also in Balta. I've heard the stories from childhood, and I know of almost 100 members of my family that perished there. I'm wondering, how much work has been done by you and your group in that area? And have you been to Bad Arlesen in Germany to coordinate your findings?
I will answer to your first question, if you don't mind. I will light on the images. So that's a typical image of the shooting. I will pass on next. Next. I will go further. Sorry, last one. This one is a typical image of the shooting. It's family image, souvenir image for the family. You see the shooters on the right, how many there are? 6, 7. You see the guy on the right is the chief of the unit. You see down the Jews who have been shot, and the guy who is on the top is the one who put the Jews down and went back. But you see in the bottom, hundreds of people are watching. Hundreds. All the village is watching like an event, the shooting of the Jews of the village. I wanted you to show that because the Nazis were proud of that, to take picture. It's only in summer 42 that Himmler said, stop to take pictures, because all Germany is learning what we are doing in East. And now I will go on, I will show you the pictures of the camp of Bogdanivka that I found back. We will go very quickly. Next. Stop. No, before. In this Walloon, they shot 45,000 Jews. The Jews of Odessa and the Jews of Bessarabia. We are in Transnistria. They said to the Jews of Odessa to take the train until Berezovka. They asked them to walk during 100 kilometers, officially no shooting. We did the road. In every farm, they remember, they were shooting Jews all the road. The road is like a cemetery. After they put all the Jews in 25 pigsties during 1 month, it was under Romanian occupation. And suddenly, Romanian got the authorization to shoot them. The Jews were very educated. They knew they would be shot. They refused to go outside of the pigsty. So they closed 5,000 Jews with fence in a pigsty and they burned them alive. So after, the others were begging to be shot. But they saw that they were burning the corpse and throwing the children in the fire alive. So it was winter. It was just before Christmas. So the mothers decided to drown their babies in the river. It was the border with Germany. We say Germany, but in fact it was Ukraine. You know how I found witnesses? On here there is the this Walloon. Just down there is a river. On the other side, it was German occupation, it was Ukraine. The German guards were giving their binocular to the young Ukrainian children who were climbing in the trees to watch the killing. I interviewed 10 women who saw the killing with binocular, and they remember, oh, he was very nice, Hans. Every day he gave the binocular, we could see the killings. You must understand, it was like a spectacle, but you will be shocked by the next image. Next. Here is a pigsty. You must understand, it's not like in Auschwitz. It was pigsties. During 1 month, they put 45,000 Jews. They shoot them, and they bring immediately porks inside. So today, it's like Auschwitz, but with porks. And no souvenir, no memorial, nothing. I met the guy who bought this pigsty. He told me, under the ground, we found a lot of Jewish artifacts. Magen David, rings, same thing, because the people before to die tried to hide what they have. Next, you see the barrack of Bogdanivka, like Auschwitz, but with pigs. All the camp is still in place, but nobody knows that it is the camp. Thank you. You must understand that everything is like one day before. It's not like here. And nothing has changed.
Thank you very much for coming here. God bless you, whatever you do, wherever you go, yes. And whatever you will go and doing the future. My question is, you have the same mass grave the same year. I don't know exactly the month. I was the witness when they're taking 40,000 Jews from Budapest, from Hungary, to Kamenets Podolsk during one night, and they're shooting. I met one of my students from the elementary school who survived with the wife. Can you tell me a few words? Did you find them?
Yeah.
I mean, the mass grave and what's happened. Thank you very much. May God bless you.
My team of Yaradio Nunum was in last August for the third time in Kamenets Podolsk. We found all the mass graves. I will give you only one fact. Before this huge killing, already the Hungarian, it was forbidden to kill Jews on the territory of Hungary. So what? Officially, if you go today in Hungary, all the Jews have been brought to Auschwitz. In fact, they brought a column of Jews, it was a mountain, climbing the mountain, and just at the border, it was legal to kill them. So just at the top of the mountain, huge mass grave were waiting, and they were shooting them. I met a witness. She was a daughter of a farmer, and her mother told her, poor, poor Jews every day had to climb this road to be shot. Every day you have to put pieces of bread in pieces of tissue in the trees, and the Jews will take them when they pass. So she told me, I was a child, I didn't understand why, but every evening we put pieces of bread and cheese in the trees, and in the morning, nothing anymore. We found one huge mass grave at the border. I'm sad to say, totally opened with excavator and all the bones outside. Not even a small zikaron like that. All this Holocaust is non-declared. I was in the Museum of Holocaust in Budapest. When I began to tell them about that, they were very scared. Because inside the museum, which is one of the best museums of Europe, nothing about that. Officially, everybody to Auschwitz. You know, everybody tries to serve us an official version. But the Holocaust was a daily murder.
Thank you very much.
That's the reason I asked you. Father, I applaud you and I applaud all the great work you're doing. May God bless you. My question is, it is well documented that the Vatican was fully aware that the Holocaust was taking place. As a representative to the Vatican, do you believe if the Vatican did not look the other way and speak out, that the Holocaust could have happened?
Of course, I will answer to your question. I am advisor to Vatican. First, the archives of the Vatican are opened until 39 only. And that's important because the Pope, Pius XII, was nuncio in Germany from 33 to 39. So already a lot of things can be learned through these archives. A copy of these archives, all of them are in the Holocaust Museum of Washington, so accessible for study. But the rest of the archives are not open. And on my point of view, and many people work for that, we don't see well how we can be clear about Pius XII without the full opening of the archives. And we are working hard for that.
Good evening, Father, and God bless you for your great work. I've actually been in contact with your organization because my family has been to a town in Ukraine, unaware of your activities, to locate a grave, the mass grave in that town.
Where?
It's called Zhirovna. It's near Stry. And we've actually contacted your office about 6 months ago. I know you have a lot going on, so you wouldn't know that offhand. But we think we located the grave, and we'll talk to your people. But one thing, when I was in Ukraine a few years ago,
you have to speak with Joanna, who is here, who is the new foreign affairs girl who follow this kind of request.
Well, that's great.
You must understand that only since we are in America, 55 families asked to us to find where is the mass grave. Yesterday, I was very moved, and the woman who is from Rabarovska will understand. All the family of the Grand Rabbi of Rabarovska came to ask me where is the grave of the Grand Rabbi of Rabarovska. And I know where it is. They are looking for it since the war.
One thing, and you touched on it earlier, one thing that we noticed, even in Lviv, if you've been to the city, it used to be called Lwów in Ukraine, the anti-Semitism, even without Jews, is so profound to this day. There's anti-Semitic literature in the main bookstore. It's just amazing. And on a daily basis, when you deal with these people, don't you find that they still harbor a lot of, at least we found, anti-Semitic latent feelings, even though the Jews are gone?
You will be surprised. First, I am completely focused to find what about the crime and where are the corpses. So even if the person is completely anti-Semite and was in the Gestapo, I'm very interested to listen to her and know what happens. And sometimes I say I prefer an anti-Semite will say the truth, but a philo-Semite will lie. Second thing, I have a bodyguard like that with a gun like that. When you have a bodyguard like that, you meet much less anti-Semites.
That's interesting. Thank you very much.
It depends. To help us, first, is at the end you give your email, you receive every 2 months a letter about what we are doing, even if it's small. We cannot say everything, because in certain countries like Belarus, if I say all what I find, I will not be able to come back. So we can have transparent explanation, but we can already say an amount. Secondly, anybody can support, we can support us, we cannot avoid the question, but even there is no small gift, a big gift, I would say anybody can participate to that mitzvah. And third, if you know families of Ukrainian, of Belarus, of Russian, many survivors are completely isolated because their story was not fitting. I will give you an example. A survivor from Haifa in Israel, German-speaking, German and Hebrew, of course, came to see me to tell me what happened. I was surprised. I said, why is he coming from Haifa? Go and come back. Plane ticket is very old. And we interviewed him in our office of Yad HaDinunum, who is in the center of Paris. 2 hours. He wanted to speak only in German and not in Hebrew. It took him 45 minutes to explain me how he could climb back from the mass grave. He was in the mass grave in Zolochiv with 1,000 Jews and not dead. And the blood was climbing. He was missing to die like that. And suddenly succeeded to jump from the blood. 45 minutes. Even me, after 2 hours of interview, I asked to stop. He told me, Patrick, you are the first person who bears to listen to me more than 1 hour. You must understand that these people, they cannot say the truth without horror. Because there is no survivor in the East without an awful story to say. So horror is like a firewall you have to cross to reach the truth. So I would say, if you know survivors or family of survivors, sometimes are very poor. I will give you another example. Yara Dinunum, we have an exhibition today in Jewish Heritage Museum in Manhattan. It was the day of the opening of the exhibition. So you know the media, an oligarch from Ukraine, etc. And suddenly, not invited, arrived 45 survivors from Brooklyn, all people from Vinnytsia. I began to speak in English to say welcome. They told me, don't speak in English. We are just an half, we speak only in Russian. All these people were very poor, never said their story. You must understand that in a month, I will give you the last example. I was in Atlanta. I gave a conference, and a woman was crying and crying. I understood immediately. She came to see me at the end, and she told me, I was in a barrack in Transnistria, and they shot in front of me 37 persons of my family. So I didn't know what to say. I said, but you were hidden? And she told me, no, they forgot me. And she told me, I wonder what I'm doing in Atlanta and why I didn't run with the rest of my family. You know, it's difficult in West to say you are a survivor because they forgot you. It's impossible to understand. So sometimes we are very isolated. So to support Yarad, of course, but I would say if you know any family of survivor, of isolated survivor, don't hesitate to connect them with Johanna, who is here, or with Marco, who is here, or with Stephanie, who is there. And we see what we can do. And for the families who are looking where there is graves, write to Johanna. We are looking now to hire somebody new, because it's a whole duty to make that with respect, with dignity, but also with truth. And it's not easy to say the truth to the family, because most of the time it's a massacre. And it's not easy to learn to the family that the mother, the great mother, has been massacred violently in front of everybody.
Excuse me, I believe that we had through this shul in the most recent conference about the science and religion, a speaker from Atlanta who is desperately trying to write the story of the parents. And once again, I think it would be very easy to make a connection with him to get out the information you have and bring out lots of support for you. I think this man may well be the son of this lady.
Thank you.
When I was a child, I read a book on Babi Yar. It was a terrible, terrible story, as we all know. Did you do any work at this site? And could you please explain to us in what you have seen and what you have discovered?
We began to work in Babi Yar. Babi Yar is inside the capital. And everybody knows Babi Yar, and they think it's the biggest place. The biggest place is not Babi Yar, it's Bogdanivka that we saw. I will treat Babi Yar only at the end because it's a geopolitical place. I only asked for 24 hours because people told me, you will not find anything in Babi Yar. There was like a changement from everything is inside the city. Nobody knows where are the corpses and so on. So I say, okay, give me only 24 hours to look for the cartridges. He said, do it, you will not find anything. With a detector of metal, in half a day, we found a month of German cartridge in a place where we knew that the corpses were down. I remember I was with a Soviet guy who told me, Father, you didn't find anything. I took the cartridges from my pocket and I said, here are the cartridges of Babi Yar. But Babi Yar is a geopolitical place, so we'll treat that only at the end. But don't forget, Babi Yar is not the main place for Ukraine.
My parents were from a town called Pukliwa in, it's been in Poland, it's been in Hungary, it's been in Czechoslovakia. It's presently in the Ukraine. I couldn't find it because it's cleaned up and it's got a new name. It's called Gukliv. And I'm very pleased that they've refurbished the cemetery. So I think they've done that to a lot of towns, and it's very hard for us. But since the, you know, we have access to the internet, and there's more and more information all the time, we can find.
What is your question?
I don't really have a question. I just have that as a comment, and also that it's very hard for children of survivors that have no family. Luckily, I'm married and I have children, and it's very difficult for us. And we're searching for family, and I've connected. I've not been able to find any of my family. I'm assuming they're in these mass graves. But I've connected a lady from England to somebody in the Midwest, and I'm from Canada. So I'm pleased that, you know, I'm doing some connections. And that's,
if we can help, you must know that we have an internet site which is called holocaustbybullets.org. And on that, you can ask for something. .com, says Marco. Holocaustbybullets.com. So here it's very easy to reach and to ask any question. And when we can, as said, some person sometimes it takes time. But when we can, we help.
But, and thank you for doing the work that you're doing. And it would please my father, who was in Dachau. And my mother, who never said a word for all of my life, who now has dementia and does not stop talking. Obviously, her long-term memory is intact. All she talks about now is the Holocaust, but she doesn't know who I am. Thank you. I'm sorry.
My name is Leonard Wien. I'm the president of the Jewish Museum here in Miami. In January, I led a group of people from Miami to provide a memorial to the members of our family who were murdered by the Nazis. There were over 500, many from Poland. My great uncle Chaim Wien was, I think, dead just before the war, but his family lived in Kiev. Is there any, and I think those who were surviving at that point were killed at Babi Yar. Is there anything that we could do to help publicize what you're doing? It would seem to me you've given us facts and figures, numbers, things that aren't well known. Is there a photographic essay?
You can have photographs. You can use also some video from us if you enter in contact. Marco is there. Marco, you can stand up so people can see you at the end.
Yes.
He's with me since 8 years. He's the general coordinator of Yarad. So put you in contact, and we can provide all what you want. We are not a business affair, so we are ready to transmit all what we have to help people to know what happened.
Yes.
And we have, of course, a professional photograph, professional cameraman, so everything is in a professional way, and you can use it or connect something by internet. But it's sure that you will see how many people we arrive say, ah, it was our history. It was our history.
Yes. Thank you.
Merci.
I have the following question. I'm reading a book called Those Were the Good Old Days, which are all memoirs of the perpetrators. And they also mention Catholic and other clergy that were chaplains reporting about the killing of the Jews. Approvingly, I remember one report about the killing of 90 babies whose parents were killed before. And they mentioned that one of the children took the hand of one of the Germans, and then she was killed. Now, some of those priests became, after the war, bishops. Now, my question is, how could the church do things like that? Horrible things like that, to promote people like that into the church?
You are right. There were people who served even in the SS units, and somebody wrote recently a PhD in the Holocaust Museum of Washington called Hitler Priests. And there were also people who saved Jews. But I agree, but you must take in account that for me it was a complete lack of moral in every level, religious, in the churches, in the political authorities, in the intelligentsia. It was, I would say, like a moral catastrophe in Europe. Otherwise, it would not have been happened. And you are right. There were people like that. And the church in France recognized all the mistakes who have been done, the heavy faults who have been done in the church about that. I agree.
Thank you very much for what you're doing 2 million times. My question is, what kind of exposure have you had to the media, such as Nightline and other kinds of programs, maybe radio programs, interviews, such like that?
In America, last year, as there was an exhibit in Paris, the publisher of the book, it was a strong public curvature in France, and we had a front page in New York Times, 3 minutes in NBC, and so on. And I would say in Eastern Europe, it's very slow. We appeared on the TV on Ukraine one time, and I don't want to appear too much, otherwise the door will be closed. But in West, we can appear. But in East, it's too early. You must understand, we never phone, we never write before arriving in a family. We don't know 1 minute before, but we are arriving with the TV 1 minute after. And it's one of our strengths. If they knew us, I think they wouldn't speak. So in West, we are very interested to be known and more than known. In East, it's more than too early. You must understand also that in Caucasus, where we want to enter, there were 10 Muslim units involved in the killing. So, by example, Chechen, Tatar, etc. So I did already many interviews in Crimea, by example, where they killed the Sephardic Jews at the exit of the mosque. It's not easy at all. You know, I am a simple person, and my team too. It's why we succeed. You know, there are two ways to cross an obstacle, above or under, and I have always chosen under. So the media in West, yes, in East, no.
I just have a suggestion. There is a very good program. Zev Brenner has a program, and I'm sure he would like to interview you.
Thank you very much for that. And that also connect with Joanna, who is here, who is connected with that, or with Stephanie, who is there.
Okay. I'd like to add that there's an organization in Houston, Texas, called Family Tree DNA. And they would like to have Holocaust survivors or children of Holocaust survivors submit their DNA because they want to do further research and to sort of try to identify these people who were murdered without any identification, and perhaps to connect them to the survivors and the children of survivors. These tests will be done free of charge to any Holocaust survivor or their children.
I respect your duty and I respect it, but you must know that on my side, I work in connection with Orthodox Judaism, and that it's forbidden to open the mass graves and to move the bones. We opened only one time to prove it was true what we were doing on request of the Jewish community. So for us, it's, I don't tell you that you have not to do it, but for us on my side, I cannot do it. I cannot open a grave to test for who. You must understand also that like in Kovel, only in Kovel, which is a small city, is 10,000 corpses in the mass graves.
Well, they also want to perhaps connect them with other surviving family members that they're not aware that there are other relatives who have survived.
Ladies and gentlemen, the night is getting long. I'm going to ask that we can take the last few questions of the people standing and then wrap it up. Thank you.
Father, can you tell me from a practical point of view, you've described the atrocities of finding mass graves with 20, 30, 50, 80,000 bodies. What do you do when you find this in order to rebury these people with dignity?
We don't rebury them because we don't unbury them. The goal is to protect the graves from the smugglers, and that it's written that there are Jewish victims and the date of the killing so that Kaddish can be said, but also that they can be respected. But for that, we are Jewish organization pushes for Yared Hinnunum to find the mass graves, because in 6 years, it will be impossible to find them because all of the witnesses will be dead. So we are seeing which other organization can take care of the covering of the graves, because only to cover one place, it takes 2-3 weeks. And we discovered already, as I told you, 850 extermination sites.
Father, I just want to tell you how much respect I have for what you're doing, the work that you're doing. I was born in 1943 in a small town in Hungary called Nyíregyháza. And the reason I'm here today is because there were 18 Christian families that hid our family in different homes from April of 1944 until April of 1945. They took their lives at risk. Their lives were a total risk. And we had to move a few weeks at a time from home to home. So I just want to tell you that there were very, very good Christians that did very good work, and you're continuing to do that work. Thank you very much.
Only in Ukraine, 2,300 persons received the Medal of Israel, a recognition to be right among the nation. But you must know, to save Jews was a strong risk in East. I met a survivor. He was hidden in a house. He has been denounced. He jumped from the window. The Nazi entered in the family. They took all the members of the Polish-Ukrainian family, and they cut them in 2 pieces and brought the pieces on the market. So what happened in East when people were saving Jews? It was a complete war behind.
My name is Herb Granick. My parents were survivors. I was born in Europe after the war. What can we do to help get you elected Pope?
You know, if I was forced to stay in Vatican, I couldn't be in the killing fields. I'm more useful, I think, when I am. You know, each one has his duty. I did many things in my life, but I think with the team of Yared Hinnunum that it's our duty today. And we are supported already by the cardinals of France, who are completely backing us. It's already, for me, very strong. And to be Pope, I think it's not my main question.
I just wanted to... I never had an opportunity to talk to anybody that was associated with the Vatican, so I'd like to make a recommendation. Because all my life, I've tried to figure out how this whole thing started. And my mother always told me that everything started with small things. So I'd like to make this recommendation. Maybe you'll bring it back to the Vatican and to some members of the Jewish community. I think you should stop using the term Old Testament. That term was devised as a derogatory process that was going to be self-perpetuating. And the problem is that is a connotation which I think perpetuates the problems that happened in Europe and today. And I think that people use the term inadvertently, Jews and Christians. And I think if we just call our Bible Torah or Tanakh or the other names that we have for it, maybe we can change the perception. God bless you. Thank you very much.
I agree. But I can tell you it needs a long-term duty. And I don't know how it is here, but in Paris, all the PhD priests study Hebrew in Mons Campus University.
I'm a survivor from the Holocaust. May God reward you with good health, with a long life, because you have lots of work to do, to be done. In Lithuania, before World War II, there were 150,000 Jews. They killed more Jews than any other country in Europe. They killed 135,000 Jews. Now that was by German and Lithuanian collaborators. I remember I was only 15 years old that somebody ran away from the mass grave. And all of us thought that he's crazy. How is that possible that? Do you plan in the future to go and look in the mass grave in Lithuania? Because percent-wise, the killing was more in Lithuania than any other place.
For the next step for Yad Unum, because there are two questions, is to find the fund, but also to train the people who are ready to go 5 times per year, 17 days per year, each time, and to stand in the cold and in bad hotels and so on until they find the graves. So for the next step is Russia and Poland. Because in Poland also, there are many mass graves that nobody wants to speak about. But you are right. Many, many people would like us to make the Baltic countries. And I know I spoke yesterday with the ambassador of France, in consul of France in New York, who was ambassador in Lithuania. But he explained me, if we want to do that, how much it will be difficult because of the violence. But we are thinking how to do it. But you are right. You are right. Ukraine, Lithuania, it's also a killing field.
Thank you.
I have two questions. In view of your admirable work, is the decoration in your lapel the Académie Française?
No. This decoration, you know, it's red. So in Soviet Union, they think it's communist, but good for me, but it's nothing to do. It's President Sarkozy who gave me personally last year what we call in French Légion d'honneur. You know, a luck for me that President Sarkozy is as small as me, so we understand each other.
My second question is, I'm heartened to hear that the Cardinals of France are supporting your work. Have you met any opposition from the Lutheran Church of Germany in your work? And does your work have the imprimatur of the Mother Church in Rome?
In one way, yes. But you know, I don't ask too strong imprimatur. When I began my research with Yad Unum, Cardinal Lustiger sent an historical dossier to Pope Benedict. He was just elected Pope since 2 weeks. And he sent a private letter written in German, signed by his hand. And he said at the end, this sentence was enough for me. He says it's good that priests work to establish the truth. So from this letter, for me, it's a strong Theuda. It doesn't mean that when I saw the Williamson affair, I was not very shocked, and I was happy that also inside the French Catholic Church, like inside the Catholic German Church, the leaders, the cardinals, wrote very strongly against Williamson, and that I repeat that any denier is only a son of Himmler and Heydrich.
And the Lutherans in Germany?
No, we have, you know, as I told you, I had the first meeting with real German people 4 weeks ago.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you again. Bye-bye.
I just want to add that for all of the accolades that you've received, in my own mind and heart, you are an honest and true and credible human being. And the fact that you, only person of another religion that said to me that the cross is avodah zara for the Jewish people. For you to have that courage, I applaud you extensively. And for your work, we thank you deeply. And everyone in this room and everyone in our community, thank you for giving those that have passed the restful honor that they need.
Thank you, Rabbi. Thank you.
This concludes the evening. There will be a book signing outside. Please join us.